From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Rod Pyle. Rod has written extensively on the U.S. space program. He works as a writer for the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory and is a frequent speaker at science and technology conferences. Pyle returns to Cool Science Radio with his new book commemorating Apollo 11's 50th anniversary. First on the Moon is his book. It offers an exciting behind-the-scenes look at America's journey to the moon, from the space race to the landing on the Sea of Tranquility to splashdown on Earth and the aftermath. Pyle spent years combing NASA archives and private collections for documents and memorabilia from the mission. And this book includes everything from accessible explanations of the enormous challenges facing NASA to reproductions of original 1969 documents. Rod Pyle, it's great to have you. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, you were, 2 years old when the space program started. You were a fervent fan from the word go, and about 13 years old, I think, when Apollo 11, when the mission occurred. And one of the things that you start your book off with is the excitement, the palpable excitement that you felt. I mean, it brought tears to my eyes as you describe hauling two TVs into the living room to see the landing. Can you take us to that day?
So I was determined to have my own little miniature mission control, and we only had two TVs in the house, both black and white, I'll add. So I did drag them together. My family thought I was nuts, but, you know, this was the kid that had spent hours alone out in the backyard building his own spaceship because I was convinced I was going to figure out a way to be the first little boy into space. A little naive, I have to say. But it kind of all fit the picture and made sense. And I just wanted to be prepared for that afternoon when that moonwalk is going to happen. Once it started, I forgot all about my preparations. I forgot all about my physical surroundings and was just drawn into those ghostly black and white images on the screen as I was watching these two human beings getting out of this tiny, fragile spacecraft. Barely enough to accomplish the task with 1960s technology. We had just graduated from using vacuum tubes in radios to transistors a few years earlier. And here these guys are landing on the moon and getting out and exploring. And it was just the most fantastic moment that I can remember. And I have to say, last year when the Falcon Heavy flew for the first time and actually worked after Elon Musk giving it about a 50-50 chance, I was taken back to those moments a bit. And I had been invited to a couple of press events, but I thought, I need to stay home because I know I'm going to be shedding a few tears when this happens. And I did. It was just incredible.
And I agree. I was a big fan as well, and it was just so exciting. Now, you were with us back in March to talk about your book, Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. We really enjoyed the conversation and the book. And I got to tell you, you've got another home run here with your book, First on Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. We've had a number of shows covering Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo from a whole bunch of different angles. And I know a lot about Apollo, but your book had so much information that I was not aware of. And with reproductions of original 69 documents, 1969, first-hand accounts, and, you know, there were pieces of this book that I was not aware of before. So I have to congratulate you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I wanted to do something a little different. I'd written about Apollo and two or three other books and tons of articles, and I edited a space magazine called Ad Astra, and I'd just done a 4,000-word article in there. But I wanted to do something a little different, not just look at the chronology of it, which is tempting in a coffee table book, but to really dive as deep as possible in a book of limited length into some of the specifics. How do you design a lunar lander when you've never done it before? How do you build these huge rocket engines Saturn V needed? Who are these people that went to the moon, these three men, Aldrin, Armstrong, and Collins? And then I think one of the most enjoyable parts was talking to some of the kids of the astronauts, in, particular Andy Aldrin and Rick Armstrong, and trying to get a sense of who their fathers were from their sons' perspectives, and also what those sons experienced while they were watching the moonwalk, because what a rare perspective that is. And it was really fun to talk to them.
Well, let's take a small piece of it. Grumman is given the lunar landing module contract to build it. They put this guy, Tom Kelly, in charge of the LEM. He has 7,000 engineers and craftsmen. They're all aerospace people. They've never designed something that was white, you know, light and insect looking. And I mean, Armstrong says that he could have put a pencil through the wall of the LEM from the inside. I mean, this was a very unusual thing to design and build for an aerospace company, wasn't it?
It was. And for all the aerospace companies involved, they'd all been building airplanes for years. They're used to working with aerodynamic structures. They're used to designing once and building many. And in this case, they're only going to build a handful of these. And the lunar module, when you've got these old school aerospace engineers working on them, they were looking at this saying, all this stuff's going to break off. You can't do this. And Kelly had to keep reminding them, no, it's only working in the vacuum of space. It'll be okay. But right up through 1968, just before the lunar landing, the lunar module was still overweight. Things were still not working. They were still having problems with the radar system. They literally finished it at the 11th hour. And as you point out, it was very lightly constructed. If you go to one of the museums and get a chance to actually touch the hull of the LEM, you can actually flex the metal with your finger because it's not much thicker than a Coke can. So they had this massive effort within the company, actually paying people thousands of dollars per gram, a bounty on weight, to get the weight down far enough that this thing could actually land and be successful. And they rose to the challenge brilliantly, considering what they were working with. It's just an incredible story.
Mm. Rod, you know, when you mentioned the Falcon Heavy landing, I was too young to remember Apollo 11. But when I saw Elon Musk's Falcon Heavy land, I did the same thing. And the number of people who also were around my age who didn't remember Apollo 11 that I've shown the video, it brings tears to everyone's eyes. But what we'll say about the Falcon Heavy is that it was an autonomous, you know, there weren't human guinea pigs inside. And I think that's what strikes me when I hear the stories about the Apollo program, that these men and their families didn't know if they were coming home at the end of the day. I just can't imagine what that would be like. But you got a sense of it from talking to families.
I did. And there was a lot of reasonable concern amongst the adults about how dangerous this was, particularly Apollo 8. There was no lunar module. Something went wrong with the command and service module. So, for instance, had that main engine failed to fire to break the sea of lunar orbit, they would have been there a really long time. They would have been this permanent monument to NASA in orbit around the moon, as one of the astronauts put it. You talk to the kids, though, and Andy Aldrin, I think, stood out in this respect because I was asking him, I interviewed him for about an hour. At the end, I said, do you have anything you want to add? And normally after an hour and a half, people being interviewed say, no, that's about it. But Andy said, yeah, I do. Actually, if I could tell you a story I'd never told a writer before, please do. Yeah. This is Nirvana. And he said, when my dad was on the moon, I wasn't worried about him ripping his spacesuit. I'm paraphrasing here, because I knew NASA was the best. And I wasn't worried about them getting stranded on the moon because I knew that NASA tested everything. What scared me the most was looking at that cable between the lunar module and the TV camera that was kind of half coiled up, but wasn't lying flat on the lunar surface. He said, I was afraid my dad was going to trip over that and embarrass me in front of my friends. And I thought, man, teenage boys are the same everywhere across time. So that was really touching to hear. They were just regular kids like anybody else whose father did this extraordinary thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great story. You know, I so often wonder about Michael Collins. I mean, you ask, you know, 9 out of 10 people will not be able to name the third astronaut on Apollo 11. And yet I think he had a really scary job staying in and orbiting the moon while the other two went down and collected rocks, right? What about him?
Well, in a sense, he was a little safer because he didn't have to make that final crossing down the lunar surface, which was very tricky and, you know, came close to disaster in a couple of moments there. Could have had serious problems. But Collins was actually very satisfied with his role. He had a lot of important science to do while he was in lunar orbit. And I think if you read his books, which are wonderfully written, he's a very gifted writer, he talks about what really was concerning him at that time was his fear that his two comrades might not make it back to the command module and that he'd have to come home alone. He could dip down to a lower orbit if they only managed to ascend to maybe 10 or 15 miles instead of the 60 where he was parked. But he could not go down the surface to get them, and had the lunar module failed to ascend, which was a very real possibility given the technology, he would have had to come home by himself. And he said that's really what scared him the most. The rest of it seemed like clockwork.
There are so many women and men that made contributions to this entire program. And culturally, we have this iconic vision of Mission Control, all these guys with their crew cuts and that sort of thing. A lot of people seem to remember that, but I just want to call out, and I'm from Boston, so we are certainly well aware of Margaret Hamilton, Director of Software Engineering for MIT, that wrote all of the code that went into the Apollo guidance computer. And, you know, from watching the movies, people know that there was a problem at some point when the craft was coming down. They got a 1201 and a 1202 error code. And she was smart enough to put this code in. If the computer gets overwhelmed, I'm going to stop and I'm going to ignore the less important tasks and not reboot, but as you're moving them out of the cache and just focus on the important ones. So the 1201 and the 1202 was brilliant on her part, and she wrote all the code, but I can't see this mission succeeding without Margaret.
No, and a lot of other people. I mean, there's so many people that worked just in the MIT lab on that program, but she was certainly a standout figure. And let's remind ourselves, this computer had 36K of memory. It's about enough to power your microwave now. It certainly wasn't running Windows 10. We know that. And it was very robust and almost foolproof. The memory was this weird kind of, by today's standards, it was little hair-thin copper wires run through magnetic beads that indicated either a one or a zero. So it was really robust but very primitive. So you're writing software for this machine that has almost no capacity. And as you say, it recovered from the errors that were occurring. There was too much data going in the computer. Had that continued to be a problem, or had the computer locked up completely or crashed, they could have been forced into an abort. And aborts are really dangerous when you're getting near to the moon, especially when you're close to the surface, because you enter this area called the dead man's box, the dead man's zone, where you don't have enough time to reverse your momentum. And even though you're firing your ascent engines, you could conceivably crash into the moon. So it was a really critical, ticklish time, and her software saved the day. And I'll add, what made her think of it, at least by her account, was that she was working late in the lab one night, writing, you know, she was coding or testing something, and her young daughter, who I think was 4 or 5, was playing inside their command module simulator and just entered some random codes in the computer, and it locked up. And that's what made Margaret realize this was a very real potential problem. She contacted NASA senior management. They said, in effect, don't worry about it. Astronauts are professionals. That'll never happen. And she went ahead and wrote that interrupt code anyway. And sure enough, on the way out to the moon on one of the missions, I think it was Apollo 8, Jim Lovell accidentally entered the wrong numbers. And the computer would have failed at that moment and lost all its navigation data had it not had her little protective bit of software written into it. So very smart lady who literally saved the day on a couple of occasions.
And she was later awarded the Medal of Freedom for her efforts. So that's pretty good stuff.
A few decades later than she should have gotten it, but I'm glad she did.
Yeah, and we only have a couple minutes left. There's so many things we can talk about. I'm going to let you choose one, or if you want us to choose, those last few seconds as Armstrong was moving the craft horizontally because he had overshot the proposed landing area, and he was seeing boulders and craters, and he wasn't sure if he could get down into a level playing field. Sorry for the pun.
Very well done. When the lunar module separated from the command module, there was a little bit of residual air in the docking tunnel, which hadn't been accounted for. So that little champagne cork pop that they experienced was enough to push them downrange a number of miles. So as Armstrong was coming in, he's taking manual control and he's looking out the window. He's got these little etched marks telling him where the landmark should be. He realizes he's well past where he wants to be. So he had to essentially take it by the seat of the pants and just find a place to set down. So as you point out, for the last period of the landing, he was hovering horizontally. And down in mission control, they're looking at the graph saying, he's supposed to be landed by now. We'd never had a simulation go out this far. But he had to get past this very large crater that he was flying over and then past a number of boulders, because anything bigger than about a beach ball could have crippled the limb and made it impossible to launch properly. So it was really, really right down to the wire, probably between 30 and 40 seconds worth of fuel left by the time he sat down. And it's just amazing that it worked out as well as it did. So that, I think his experience in the X-15 had to have contributed to that success.
Before we let you go, I just want to make sure that our listeners know this is a coffee table book with all kinds of incredible photos that you have put together, but it's also a story. The story quotes from the missions, from mission control, and it's just such a pleasure to look at and to read.
I really appreciate that, and I think Sterling, the publisher, really went beyond the pale. It did a wonderful cover with embossed lettering and all the little things that we don't think about, but that make such an impression. And the printing of the book was just spectacular. So hats off to Sterling and their editors for doing such a fine job. I was really thrilled to work with them again.
Our guest is Rod Pyle and his book, First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Thanks so much for joining us again, Rod. Great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to coming back.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.